This material is subject to copyright. No unauthorized recording, editing, copying, or distribution is permitted without the consent of the Economic Research Council. All rights reserved. For more information, visit www.ercouncil.org. Audio lectures by the Economic Research Council.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed for coming. It's a great pleasure to be here. And I feel very lucky to be here because we are, by delightful coincidence, in the middle of a little virtual economics bubble cum explosion cum thing. And I've been following bitcoins and various sort of virtual economic bits and pieces for the last few years. And I would consider myself to be an interested observer rather than an expert. So what I would like to take this opportunity to do is to try and outline what I think are some of the interesting features about them and then pick your brains shamelessly and see what this gathered audience of experts thinks about the things I've said and about what comes next, because people are obsessing about bitcoins, you know, for good and interesting reasons. But in a way, for me, they're most interesting as a glimpse into the future, a peek into possibilities. And there are very interesting questions around which of these possibilities will lead on to other things and which of these possibilities will vanish in a puff of dot-com smoke. So I'm going to try and talk engagingly and clearly about bitcoins, which is challenging, for half an hour or so. And then I say I'll be very grateful indeed to see what you think in return and what you think is most salient. And I want to start with just a few numbers. Bitcoin numbers, it's great. You can get incredible amounts of detail about them. I finished this off at 11:26 this morning when there were 11 million bitcoins in circulation, which just took them for the first time past the total market cap of $2 billion, with 57,000 transactions in the last 24 hours. And numbers like this have been thrown around a lot recently. But people end up going, well, you know, but what are they? What actually are they, apart from a nice idea or a gift to headline writers who want to get excited about digital stuff? So I want to start off by showing you a few graphs. I mean, among other things, they're a bubble. I'm not an expert economist, but this looks like bubble territory to me. This is the market cap of bitcoins. This is not a logarithmic scale, but it may have to be one soon. So, you know, remarkable stuff has happened. And there's another graph I'll show you, which I promise is different, but which speaks to this first graph. This is Google searches for bitcoins. You can see a correlation between those two graphs. So this is very interesting. People have got excited about them, talked about them a lot, sent the price soaring up into the stratosphere, and yet people probably mostly don't understand what's going on. They just understand that if they bought them anywhere to the left of right now, they made money, which is perhaps all you need to understand with many things. But I would like to look, first of all, at what underlies this, and then some of the good things, the interesting stuff, and then some of the problems. So, bitcoins began in 2009. They're very, very young. And this quote is attributed to Satoshi Nakamoto, who you'd be delighted to know doesn't exist and may not even be human. Satoshi Nakamoto claimed to be a 36-year-old Japanese male, and he launched bitcoins on the 3rd of January 2009 with a kind of manifesto from which this is taken. And it was a manifesto very squarely aimed at the boom and bust cycles of conventional economics, and particularly the credit crunch and macroeconomic crisis. And he said the root problem with conventional currency is all the trust that's required to make it work. The central bank must be trusted not to debase the currency, but the history of fiat currencies is full of breaches of that trust. Bitcoin is completely decentralized, with no trusted parties. In a way, I'll explain exactly how Bitcoin is constructed, but this was the thinking behind it. It was to come up with, well, in inverted commas, a currency. It's not really a currency in many ways, but to come up with a fiscal system that was totally decentralized, that was entirely maintained, composed, justified and guaranteed by every single member of the network running its software on an equal footing. So you are united, so to speak, in mutual suspicion of everything. This was the idea behind it, and it sounds, well, like all sorts of random anarchistic writings you find all over the internet, really. The difference is that this bit of random anarchistic writing actually created something that has the graphs I was just showing you. There's an interesting analogy to a rather more a well-known financial gentleman, Mr. Warren Buffett, who in 2012, in his letter to investors, was saying very similar things, or at least he was pointing out a basic economic fact, that investments denominated in a given currency that they're thought of as safe, in truth, are among the most dangerous of assets. And he meant this historically, and he referred to the purchasing power of the US dollar over his long career. Governments, he said, determine the ultimate value of money, and systemic forces will sometimes cause them to gravitate to policies that produce inflation. And in a way, this is the other half of the Bitcoin credo. Do not let governments control the supply, because then if no one can meddle, if no one can print this stuff, if no one can have a policy towards it, if it's completely decentralized, then it will, so to speak, do its own thing. It will be immune to the tendencies that, as Nakamoto saw it, or whoever he was, we have no... He vanished in 2011. He's gone. He stopped existing, as far as we know. So it was trying to come up with something immune to this. And that involves three things, which I'm going to try to explain lucidly. I'm sure there's some people here who could do the maths on the back of an envelope before I could finish explaining it, and some people who probably couldn't, and I'm maybe somewhere in between, so I'm going to try and explain it. There's three things that underpin the Bitcoin, and if you understand these three things in essence, hopefully you understand what they are, what the philosophy driving them is. And they rest, first of all, on public key cryptography. And public key cryptography is what guarantees their security. If I want to give you my bitcoins, because there is no bank behind them, there's just a bit of software that all of us are running on our computers if we want to be part of the system. And that has a public key and a private key. The private key is my unique private security guarantee that I hold on to and that nobody ever sees. And the public one is, if you like, the show of good faith that can be verified, or that has to be verified, by every single peer in the network automatically. So if I want to give you some bitcoins, what I do is, those coins exist in an electronic wallet as just a software idea on my computer. They uniquely exist as a unique string in my wallet. And I take those coins and I sign them with my private key. And the transaction is then broadcast openly to the entire network of everybody else running this software. And the rest of the nodes in the network, that is, everybody else connected to the network, they validate the signature and the amount of the transaction and then rebroadcast it publicly. And these transactions are the public side of the key, and it's only by combining these two things, my private thing attached to the coins, attached to somebody else's key, and then broadcast publicly, that we get a transaction that is verified by the network. And it is irrevocable, because each transaction has a timestamp. And the timestamp, in technical terms, has sequential identifiers. But all this means is you cannot ever use bitcoins twice. They are passed on, single transaction. And then that transaction is timestamped to a particular moment. That time is verified by everybody in the network, and the transfer occurs. It occurs once and once only. And this deals with a huge problem that all other attempts to do this kind of thing have had before, which is of doing stuff twice and fooling people. I probably haven't given the most lucid explanation of this in the world. We will revisit it later, and I will go through it again and attempt to do better. But the thing to hold on to here is the idea that it's a combination of complete peer-to-peer transparency and unique security individually. And then it is done on peer-to-peer networking. So this means that there is no central bank, there is no central authority. everybody running the Bitcoin software is part of the guarantee of that currency. That currency exists in a database which everybody shares, which everybody verifies every time a transaction takes place. And every single transaction is uniquely time-stamped, happens once, and then is consigned irrevocably to the past. And I can just go online, as I did when I pulled out those first numbers, and pull off all the latest details off the servers. I can see what the unique public encrypted identifiers for each transaction are. I can trace that transaction. I can verify it. I can make sure that everything has happened once and only once between two people and only two people. And the moment that's happened, it then goes back into the impenetrable meshes of encryption, which is to say it's very secure. And finally, mining. Now, this is the really interesting bit, because this is the clever thing about Bitcoins, I guess, is how to, well, where do they come from in the first place? And the great idea behind this was to make them like gold. What you do is when Bitcoin started and you put the software on your computer was effectively running that program and performing very difficult calculations in an exercise called mining. So there is a central depository of all the potential Bitcoins in the world called the blockchain. And as the different computers on the network chomp away at deliberately difficult, sort of effectively random computational tasks, the blocks in the blockchain yield up their Bitcoins, like the earth yielding up gold ore, at a predetermined rate. And when Bitcoin started out, and there weren't very many people mining, on my desktop computer, I could mine Bitcoins at the rate of sort of 10 or 20 a day. And as more and more people come on board and start running the software, it gets harder and harder in computational terms to be the lucky person who unearths the block that has the Bitcoins in. And because it's peer-to-peer, every computer in the world running the software is tied into exactly the same blockchain, i.e. exactly the same, if you like, kind of underground resource. And it's set up so that there will only ever be a maximum of 21 million Bitcoins in history ever. That is completely set. And it gets harder and harder and harder to mine them as more people come on. And now it's so hard to mine them that you find adverts for things like this. This is a $2,500 will buy you a 50 gigahertz Bitcoin miner, which is a computer specifically set up to be optimized for Bitcoin mining. Bitcoin mining on your own is no longer worthwhile. They've become so popular. So what you usually do is get together with other people and form effectively a guild or a club, and you're all running your computers trying to do these increasingly elaborate calculations to try and get the lucky block that will release the next little tranche of Bitcoins. And once they come from that block, you've then agreed to split them between your guild or your collaboration of miners. And you may be running this specialized hardware. Of course, nowadays, it's probably easier just to buy them on one of the many, many exchanges where I can pay dollars for them, rather than to be using up the electricity to run my computers. Or I could do nefarious things like try and hijack other people's computers and unwittingly get them to mine my Bitcoins. But this is, I think, a rather wonderful idea, that you have these entirely virtual blocks which contain needles in haystacks, so to speak. And when a new block is announced, because we have this peer-to-peer network, the other nodes in the network all confirm that this block follows all the rules of the protocol. And then if it does, it yields up its little bit of Bitcoins to the lucky person who mined it, or to the lucky consortium. And then the next ones are even harder to get, and you need effectively a supercomputer to get them, or lots of computers working in parallel, each hoping to be lucky. So anyway, so this may have been one of those explanations that didn't explain anything. What exactly is a Bitcoin? Well, what a Bitcoin is, to me, is an understanding, a balance in a decentralized general ledger, as you might put it. They are effectively the side effects of vast amounts of meaningless computational work, of very, very hard computer work. And they are worth precisely as much or as little as you think they are. They are their own entirely self-contained thing, constructed out of the trust or lack of trust of everybody running the software. That's it. It's not pegged to anything. Counterfeiting it is an immense chore that would require supercomputers. It's been described as a hedge against the entire global currency system, to put your money into bitcoins. The only thing to trust or distrust, if you like, is maths itself. And because all the maths is completely public, and because a lot of people have spent a very long time trying to crack these encryptions and decided they're pretty good, because every time a bitcoin is mined out, everybody in the entire community both verifies it automatically and knows about it and sees it announced. And every time a transaction is done, it's done one-off, secured, irrevocably between two unique people and verified by the network and then vanishes. It has a lot of unique properties that have made it, well, very tempting in volatile times. So, there's a lovely line from Paul Ford at Business Week, who I was quoting just now. There's nothing to trust but math. And suddenly an idea that sounded terrible, a totally decentralized currency without a central authority, where semi-anonymous parties exchange meaningless tokens, becomes almost comforting, a source of power and authority. So a few anecdotes and then a few observations. Because I think it's still very hard to grasp what all this means until we see how people are using it and responding to it. After all, this is just a nice thought experiment if it weren't for the fact that it's at a market cap of over $2 billion and climbing at an alarming rate. Cyprus, 29th March 2013, very recently. This, you may not be able to see this. This is a screen grab of a YouTube video, which now I think is rather a nice sign of Bitcoin, that someone has written a party rock anthem in honour of Bitcoin. This, it says below, that's when I learned about the blockchain. I'm not going to play it to you because that would be very disturbing and probably not very decorous. But you know, Cyprus has had some financial troubles recently, including a central government, doing the kind of thing that spooks people when it comes to cash by removing a certain percentage of everybody's. It tends to get people a bit nervous. And among other things, people in Cyprus have started investing a bit of money in Bitcoin. It's not a huge amount, but its interest has spiked there for very obvious reasons. But this song is an interesting emblem of the attitude. I'll quote you some of the lyrics, because I think they're very revealing. So if you imagine there's a pumping dance beat, and someone in English, a Cypriot in English, singing this homage to a particular currency, and being conducted. Thank you very much, someone knows it. Just when the Cypriots were losing faith, that's when I learned about the blockchain. I still remember how it all changed. Satoshi said, don't you worry, child. Bitcoin has got a plan for you. Don't you worry now. Now, I like this because it says quite a lot about the kind of people who are interested in bitcoins. It's a nice quote from a writer called Zachary Seward on the Quartz website, who says this new anthem has the feel of a classic YouTube conspiracy video mixed with local TV advertising for gold coins and Arab Spring propaganda. It's a kind of gold bug thing, cum funky YouTube virality, which is about right. It's a mixture of themes. It's a mixture of quintessentially digital themes in some ways, or online themes, a mixture of doomsday, liberty, and anarchy. A mixture of conspiracy theories. You know, bitcoins have saved us because they allow us to stick it to the man, to finally get away from banks, to finally put our currency in something where we don't have to trust anyone, where we can be properly anarchistic. And in many ways, this is revealing and also something we want to see beyond, because it's very easy to write bitcoins off entirely as a bubble pumped up by fear, irrationality, and the sort of atavistic desire to have something decentralized. And then, you know, speculation is just taking hold of this and getting everything it can out of the bubble before it explodes and everybody, you know, wonders where all their money went. But in fact, whatever happens with the market, the ideas behind Bitcoin are very potent. And particularly, I think, the way that the ideas behind the currency of this peer-to-peer, radically decentralized currency gels with a lot of other things we see online and a lot of the other ways that the virtual interfaces with the real. If you like, although we may be dismissive about conspiracy theories like this delightful one about dollars, I'm not quite sure even what this one says, but it says that it's all conspiracy, but even bitcoins are a conspiracy. But if we look behind that, I think we get some interesting stuff that I think can tell us interesting things about future opportunities and about things that are, so to speak, that go with the grain of our times. So, opportunities. I'm going to go through five opportunities, and then for the sake of rhetorical symmetry, five hazards or problems that counterbalance them. So five opportunities first. And the first thing is frictionless exchange. Nice picture of frictionless. That's what frictionless exchange looks like on the internet. Everything has to have a cute picture of an animal. That's one of the rules. So bitcoins, I mean, in one sense, they're like cash. If I give you $100, it's anonymous and it's untraceable. But we need to be in the same place, and we probably need to be somewhere where dollars are regarded as having value, which is a lot of the world, but not all of it. And I need to be there in person, or a proxy does. I can, you know, give you the envelope with the money stuffed into it. Now, with bitcoins, the transfer can take place across continents, across time zones, with no problems, with no time lag, with almost non-existent transaction fees, and with security, irreversibility, and transparency, that combination, guaranteed by the very nature of the system. I cannot do a Bitcoin transaction with you that is insecure. There is no such thing. They have to be secure in order to take place, because the private key that only I hold has to be matched to the public key, matched, verified by everybody else in the system. And the entire system has to say, yes, that transaction happened, in order for the entire grand mathematics of it to shift on and locate the bitcoins in your wallet rather than in my wallet. And this is rather amazing when one considers the enormous amounts of friction involved in currency exchange. And also, it doesn't involve banks. It doesn't involve any centralized regulation of money supply. It doesn't involve bothersome things like taxes, for example. Because if you're remotely careful when you're doing it, and the computer and the IP address you're doing it from are concealed, which is fairly easy using onion routing or, you know, sort of a standard IP concealment setup, no one can possibly know it was you and the protocols built into it. Because it's all public, they've been iterated many times, are very, very good indeed at protecting people from sniffing out even who you might be. Now, this obviously makes it rather handy for, should we say, doing more than just buying books. You can buy and sell anything. This is not much of an exaggeration. Currently, currency exchanges, exchanging bitcoins into different currencies, dollars, pounds, yuan, etc., exist in dozens of currencies online. Also, you can buy quite a lot of things directly with bitcoins without any currency or bank accounts being involved. You need a bank account if you want to sell them for dollars. You don't need a bank account if you want to gamble with them. In most online casinos, will delightedly accept them, probably at the moment, because what their take will be worth more at the end of the roulette wheel spinning than when it started to spin, but they will accept it. People have bought houses with them by mutual agreement. There's posh hotels in America that will accept bitcoins as payment just so. And more notoriously, there is a site called Silk Road, which some of you may have heard about, that made the headlines in 2011. It played a big role, in fact, in the very first Bitcoin bubble, where you can buy things that are not available in traditional marketplaces, like drugs. They don't do weapons, but you can buy lots and lots of drugs on there. Silk Road, you have to have your computer set up with a degree of security, with routing systems that conceal your IP. You can't access it otherwise. But then once you go on, because of the nature of Bitcoin exchanges, you can use them with other people to buy and sell almost any drug imaginable in the world. This is not, I think, a particularly good thing, but it is certainly an interesting thing. They are transparently secure. And I made this point before, but I've given it its own little point because it's very important. So the source code for Bitcoin, the software that makes it exist, that supports it, it's free and it's public. And this tends to be very good digital practice in many ways, because it means that pretty much every cryptographer and hacker in the world has had a good crack at it. And the conclusion they come to is, this is some pretty good encryption you've got going on here. For those of you who are interested, it uses a military-grade encryption, SHA-256, a 256-bit US Department of Defense protocol, and also ECDSA, which is elliptical curve-based security, which is just really secure, really secure. You need to spend incredible amounts of money on computation to try and even remotely spoof it. But also, and perhaps more interestingly, let's say I crack it. Let's say I've got here a quantum computer that can crack it and that can steal all these bitcoins. Well, if that happens, because it is open source, because it is public, because it is shared, because everybody sees every transaction, the moment people see stuff, you know, all going towards me and I've cracked it, it can simply shift to a stronger algorithm. It's very hard to break the system. There was a bit of a problem earlier this month with what's called a fork. In programming, a fork is where two different versions of something coexist. And some of the blocks basically got cut off from the central system and stopped talking to the central system. It was a bit technical. It was also potentially absolute disaster for stuff that's now really, really valuable. It lasted a couple of hours. And then, rather miraculously, the sort of first among equals in the system all agreed how to fix it, and it was fixed. Everybody said, fine. They sort of stepped up. It was got over very fast indeed. Knowing your limits, this is another thing I alluded to earlier. This is a graph of Bitcoin supply. If you look to the right, you can just about see, we've got, what have we got there? About 2031 on the right. This is the graph of how many Bitcoins there are in the world. At any time, we can do what I did this morning and say there are now just over 11 million. We know there will never be more than 21 million, and we know that their mining will occur at exactly this rate. We don't know who will get the lucky nodes. We don't know where they'll sort of pop and release their delicious Bitcoin goodness. But we do know exactly what's going to happen. So it's like gold, except it's unlike gold because there's no large seams. There's no one discovering a fortune. There's never going to be a glut. Come 2021, we'll be slowed down. And so there's complete certainty, which in one sense could be a good guarantee of fundamental value. And finally, there is the abandoning of old institutions, which appeals intensely to the internet anarchist in all of us, but probably also appeals to all of us at some time in terms of getting hit by bank charges or discovering that most of the costs of an online transnational business are processing payments in God knows how many different countries, in God knows how many different places, and talking to credit card companies and delights like that, which I'm sure you know a lot more about than I do. But the temptation, the frictionless of being able to abandon the old institutions, this is certainly very interesting and very different from older digital currencies, because there have been plenty of virtual currencies. Something called Second Life had its own currency. People buy and sell stuff in video games like World of Warcraft. Facebook has credits. Microsoft has points. All of these are significant. All of these are fiat currencies, closely and jealously guarded by the corporations that guarantee them, valuable within their walled gardens, maybe essential, but to some degree they have little value outside these ecosystems. Their fungibility is incredibly limited. So these are some of the interesting things, the interesting potential advantages of bitcoins, and here are some, I hope, interesting problems. And in many ways, I'm most interested in the problems, because bitcoins are not the future. Bitcoins are a peek into the future, a peek into possible futures. And, you know, that is what I think is interesting about them, using them to try and glimpse behaviours and opportunities that other systems will use and that will be built on by conventional systems. I don't think they're going to replace the old, but I think the old may well adopt many aspects of these. So you have to trust someone. This is really interesting. Bitcoin is based on mistrust. Mistrust everyone. Trust the maths. Except it's quite nice to be able to trust someone rather than just hiding my money under my mattress. I quite like, at least in principle, the idea of being able to trust a bank and having certain guarantees around my deposits. And if my bitcoins are terribly valuable, although the Bitcoin system is very secure, my poor old computer running Windows 8 is not exactly the digital Fort Knox I would like it to be. So what I would probably like to do is find someone I can pay to look after my bitcoins for me with a guarantee in a separate system. So ironically, the paranoia around them and the fact they're so valuable and the fact that people can hack my computer and then get at my secure Bitcoin wallet, and it's so secure I can't get it back, means that really I want a bank of Bitcoins that will offer guaranteed deposits of Bitcoins. So there's a slight circularity to the paranoia here. And median speculation is the other thing. We saw those graphs at the start. Really, the point is, Bitcoins are driven so far by talk about Bitcoins. So in July 2010, Slashdot, a very influential site, posted a short item about Bitcoins, and their value went up tenfold. Gawker, popular gossip place, published a piece about Silk Road, about the online marketplace where you can buy anything, back in 2011. That piece was read a million times, and the price of Bitcoins shot up to $33 a piece, having never been at a double digit before. For speculators, it's all very, very compelling. So if I didn't, sadly, if I'd spent $100 on Bitcoins before that first Flashdot piece came out in 2010, I didn't, sadly, I wish I had done, that would have been worth, by the time that Gawker piece came out, a year later, $72,000. Just after that, it would have gone up to $250,000. And a few days ago, it would have been worth over $1 million, which would have been a good return on investment. So, that's very sad. I'm very sad about that. But this is interesting, because if we're talking about speculation, and if we're talking about the attention paid to things like Silk Road, to some degree, speculators are betting on media coverage and media frenzy, but speculators are also, if you like, betting on the online future of illegal trading, which is quite a good bet, really. But that's not necessarily an incentive that's aligned with many social goods or ultimate goods for fiscal systems. And this leads us to this, commodity or currency. I've been saying currency, but really, really bitcoins are a highly volatile commodity. There is a supply of them. It's going to be mined. It's driven by speculation. It's pegged to how much we think people want to buy drugs and not get caught. It's governed by rules of scarcity. It's subject to speculative manipulation and attack. It's very hard for that to be a currency. And it's limited to 21 million, too, which means it's not going to become a global system of exchange anytime soon because of the limits to it. At the moment, even at this very high value, all the bitcoins that will ever be mined is like a few thousand gold bars, quite a lot of gold bars, but not enough to prop up the world financial system. And if they become too valuable, and too universal, they will, so to speak, hollow out the value of all the work done for them. They will, a lot of perverse effects in there. There's also the small fact that they may be completely illegal, which is again puts a bit of a damper on using them in parallel with legitimate finance. The FBI has said it's a violation of federal law for individuals to create private coin or currency systems to compete with official coinage. There's a lot of laws that could be used against bitcoins that haven't necessarily yet, but operating unlicensed money transmitting businesses is certainly not legal in many jurisdictions. So this is problematic, to say the least. And they are an invitation to hack. Very good book, this. The thing is, if I have to spend $2,500 on custom mining equipment to try and make bitcoins, or I have to join a consortium and burn, hundreds of dollars worth of electricity to try and find a little bit of bitcoin if I'm lucky, I'm much better off spending all that energy trying to hijack other people's computers and turn them into zombies mining bitcoins for me, or I'm much better off just trying to find someone who's got their bitcoin wallet open on a computer that is not completely secure. Back in June the 12th, 2011, we had one of the first big Bitcoin heists. A user who we don't know who this person really is, we know that they had a nickname all in vain, They went to bed with their Windows machine turned on, and on that computer was a wallet containing 25,000 electronic coins. When they woke up the next morning, an entirely legitimate transaction, not performed by them, but performed on their computer, had transferred those elsewhere. And that was that. The value of those 25,000 coins today, about $3.5 million to $4 million. And because of the nature of the system, because once a timestamp transfer has occurred between nodes, within a few seconds, it's vanished on the cryptographic layers. It's gone. It's irrevocable. You never know who anybody is. There's a very strong incentive to perform those kind of thefts, should we say. There's $1 million incentive to spend your computer power nefariously rather than bothering to do it legitimately or even speculating. So there's a lot of perverse incentives. So what's next? And this is the bit where I wrap up and I say, you know, over to you to some degree, over to the world. I hope I've outlined a few interesting ideas and managed at least to quasi-explain the nature of the system and some of the interest and trends around it. I think it's rather fascinating. It's a lovely quote from Felix Salmon, writing for Medium, an online site. He's written a fantastic article, which I would very, if you read one thing, read Felix Salmon writing about bitcoins. And he, in optimistic mode, at the end of his piece, says about payment walls are extremely effective barriers to trade. And if they come down, we'll get much more trade, with transactions getting orders of magnitude smaller than what we're seeing now. The disruption and the global wealth creation could be truly enormous. And he there is talking about what to me is perhaps the most interesting suggestion from bitcoins, which is not currency and not a commodity, but which is the idea of verifiable, secure, friction-free payment systems on a truly global peer-to-peer basis that do not require direct interface with banking systems, but which could be, as it were, backed by them in terms of getting rid of the perverse incentives, the criminality, and even the wild speculations on the future of online criminality and anarchist gullibility and Cypriots writing songs, although one may wish to speculate about that. But, you know, if we're looking at what can be accomplished with the maths of this and what can be accomplished with this kind of peer-to-peer thinking, then we may eventually see something that doesn't have these limits, that can grow organically, that could be used as a payment mechanism, that's not a store of value or a source of speculation, and that could work with the grain of existing monetary institutions rather than against them. So I think we have an interesting window into the future here, an interesting opportunity, and, you know, quite a good sideshow as well. I recommend reading pieces about bitcoins, if only because the entertainment value is extremely high compared to most of the other goings on the finance at the moment. Thank you very much indeed.